He says, should I tell you what is, that Allah will account him on something very small. That's a wise thing. That's something that shows the fact that Allah will account for everything. And he tells his son this. He tries to train his son for the hereafter. You see, training your sons for the hereafter is to tell them about the accountability that will be done in each and every aspect of life.
True, yes. That's a very good point that you mentioned. So we'll stop here and inshallah we'll continue on this in the next episode. Thank you very much for joining us on this program, dear listeners. And if you have any questions, any comments, any suggestions, please contact us at our email, englishradio@irib.ir, and visit us at our website, parstoday.com, and subscribe to our YouTube channel and Facebook page, Call of Islam Radio. Inshallah, till the next program, fi amanillah.
Islam solves all of its problems. Allah leaves no stone unturned. Perfect with no flaws at all are the laws of Allah. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life. A complete way, it's a complete way.
Economic divide.
The U.S. economy is not doing well. So are the economies of many countries across the globe. So what makes the U.S. different? Well, aside from having the highest infection rate in the world, it may have a new president. Incoming President-elect Joe Biden, if confirmed, as reported by the media.
As I said on Saturday, I'm humbled by the trust and confidence the American people have placed in me and in Vice President-elect Harris. And we're ready to get to work addressing the needs of the American people. Today, that work begins. It starts with doing everything possible to get the COVID-19 under control.
Yeah, key word there, control. But will Biden and his team be able to deal with a problem that is so severe, a problem that has just ravaged the U.S.? One of the consequences, hunger. Check this out. This is what's going on at an L.A. food center.
Pre-pandemic, we measure things in pounds, and we were distributing about 1.5 million pounds every week in and out of our distribution centers. And now we're running at 4 million pounds a week coming in and out of our distribution centers here in South L.A. and Commerce.
Hello, welcome to Economic Divide with me, Kavit Atwaib. In this week's episode, we will take a look at the U.S. economy, how on earth it can climb out of the economic downturn, mainly due to the COVID-19 pandemic, and whether the current U.S. president or the incoming president-elect, as reported by the media, have a game plan to tackle this monumental challenge. Now, first, let's take a look at President-elect Joe Biden. He has said that business and labor leaders have signaled willingness to operate to fix the U.S. economy. He also stressed that the coronavirus first must be brought under control. He said more people would die if President Donald Trump continues blocking a U.S. transition of power. The incoming president-elect also urged Congress to pass relief legislation. As of the recording of this program, no relief deal in sight, as crucial pandemic relief programs are due to be shut down by the end of the year. Now, U.S. Congress needs to act fast. For the first week of November, this is a reason why they need to act fast. The U.S. has registered a total of 742,000 new applications for unemployment compensation. Now, that means tens of millions of Americans are out of work. How is the incoming U.S. administration, once confirmed, be able to bring back these jobs?
American voters did not elect Joe Biden because they thought that he would be the best man to revive the economy. The economy may well define his presidency nonetheless. Biden will take office in January amid a crisis brought about by the pandemic. which is capable of causing immensely more economic harm before vaccination is widespread. You will also inherit a business landscape in the throes of a once-in-a-generation shift, as technology becomes more embedded in everyday life and in more industries, a shift that has been simultaneously hastened and overshadowed by the disease.
Biden's program is very, very well targeted to be able to reverse the economic downturn, because what it involves is a lot of spending at the local level to improve infrastructure, to change the mixture of sources of energy, to provide for local social services, to attend to the health problem, and to reinstate programs for worker welfare.
Whether Biden succeeds or fails depends on how he manages these twin sources of change. Make no mistake, it is not like the U.S. president-elect lacks experience dealing with economic woes. When he became the vice president of Barack Obama in 2009, it was the depth of the Great Recession, with the U.S. economy having lost nearly 3.6 million jobs the prior year and still shedding jobs at a rate of 800,000 a month. But the U.S. economy now faces different challenges than in 2009.
The basic question here is, how bad is the U.S. economy doing? I mean, it's very simple to see that if we were to break down the numbers in the different economic sectors that show the depth of the crisis. For starters, the unemployment numbers. It is estimated that over 30 million Americans may have lost their jobs. Now add to that the millions of workers who were out of the jobs or out of their jobs before the pandemic. That number could creep up to 40 million easily. Keep in mind, many unemployed have given up work and are not being recorded. Then comes the poverty rate. The official poverty rate in the U.S. was registered at around 10% for the year 2019, before the pandemic hit. Now, when the $600 a week bonus unemployment payments stopped, poverty rates actually increased. Latest figures indicate about 7 million people are now living below the poverty line. Again, keep in mind the variance, since many are not being reported. And finally, what about economic growth? At one point, the U.S. GDP dropped in 2020, in the second quarter, that is, was the worst in its modern history. It was down 32.9%. That being the largest quarterly drop since the Great Depression. And since then, the U.S. has regained just two-thirds of that figure.
Biden has repeatedly said that before America could rebuild its battered economy, it needed to get the virus under control.
COVID is a terrible disaster. The United States right now is the largest loci for infections, and now has surpassed 250,000 deaths.
The coronavirus has affected almost every country around the world. Many have taken an economic hit this year as a result. However, while citizens of other countries generally agree on how to move forward, Americans have a wide ideological divide that could make Biden's job much harder, as presidents often draw on public support to help push their agendas forward.
Economic recovery, his view of economic recovery is a recovery that's based upon doing something at the very, very grassroots level. And that's extraordinarily important to reverse the kind of top-down corporate subsidies, corporate welfare that the Trump administration offered.
A survey conducted over the summer found that among citizens of economically advanced countries struggling to contain the virus, Americans were the most polarized along party lines in their assessments of the government's response to the virus and the economy. Furthermore, another poll from October revealed that only 24% of Trump supporters said that the coronavirus outbreak was very important to their vote, compared to 82% of Biden supporters. Conversely, 84% of Trump supporters said that the economy was very important, versus 66% of Biden supporters. Biden has promised to follow the advice of public health advisors, even if they recommend shutting down businesses. Biden's supporters may applaud that approach, but he will find it challenging to convince the rest of the country that it's the right way to go, especially Trump's most ardent loyalists, many of whom have shunned even basic preventative measures like masks. The congressional situation is a major obstacle for Biden's agenda as well. The U.S. president-elect may get only parts of his broad plans spanning everything from child care to infrastructure to climate change through a gridlocked Congress.
Okay, joining us in the studio today is Craig Holman. PhD serves as a Public Citizens Capitol Hill lobbyist on ethics, lobbying, and campaign finance rules. Now, Craig is an expert on campaign finance reform, governmental ethics, lobbying practices, and the impact of money in politics. Previously, he was senior policy analyst at the Brennan Center for Justice, New York University School of Law. Craig, welcome to Economic Divide. The U.S. President Donald Trump's economic plans were deemed a success before COVID-19. But right now, we're looking at a massive economic devastation. For example, unemployment at an all-time high, pretty much. Business bankruptcies also at an all-time high. Increasing poverty. President-elect Biden, once confirmed, has focused on spending with a lockdown to incur beforehand. Do you think he's going to be able to jumpstart the economy?
Biden's going to make every effort at jumpstarting the economy. And I suspect when it comes to the COVID-19 pandemic, he will succeed on this. Biden has laid out his plans. First things first, and that is number one on his priority.
Okay, you say disastrous Trump administration. Biden has focused on four major areas to transform the U.S. economy: COVID-19, economic recovery, racial equity, and climate change. Are those four areas going to work?
Well, there's actually his whole program is different than what we've seen with the Trump administration. Biden has laid out his economic plans through the course of the campaign. At first, he's going to focus on working class interests, which, by the way, is an absolute reversal from the Trump administration. Trump has favored the very wealthy. He's given tax cuts to the wealthy, tax cuts to the corporations. Biden plans on reversing those tax cuts to the wealthy.
Okay, you apparently are very pro-Trump, but I'm going to play devil's advocate. Are you looking at Biden's economic initiatives in which the transition team says it wants to mobilize American manufacturing and innovation and build a modern infrastructure for clean energy?
I was mentioning that one of Biden's priorities is infrastructural development, and that includes energy along with roads and bridges and the entire infrastructure that makes the economy operate. Biden has pledged so far to spend about $1 trillion on developing the infrastructure for the U.S. economy over a period of about 10 years. That's going to have to be negotiated once again with the Republican Senate. So whether he gets to go that far, it remains to be seen. But that is going to be the new emphasis coming out of the White House.
And finally, how do you think the U.S. is going to be able to offset China's economic influence globally and its penetration into U.S. markets when China is already ahead in its post-COVID-19 period, all the numbers say so, while the U.S. is still grappling with the COVID-19?
There are two different questions in there. First of all, this is something Biden can do pretty much on his own. We've seen Trump alienate our international colleagues, literally lock out of any kind of negotiations, countries like Iran or China. And Biden is not of that ilk. Biden wants to work with our international colleagues. He wants to open up relations and communications with countries like Iran and China. And so we're going to see a big change. And Biden can do that on his own as the executive. He doesn't need congressional approval on a lot of this. So we are going to see changes there.
Okay, thank you very much for that. That's Craig Holman, Public Citizens Capitol Hill lobbyist, with his statements there. Obviously very pro-Biden, again, once Biden gets elected, or confirmed, I should say. Well, it's time for a quick break here on Economic Divide, but don't go anywhere. We have plenty more coming up in the next half of the program. Welcome back to Economic Divide with me, Kavitavai. In this in-depth section, we are going to put the current Treasury Secretary, Steven Mnuchin, under the spotlight. Why? Well, it first started with this headline. Paul Krugman, the famous economist, slammed the Trump administration plot to sabotage the economy and hurt Biden. The article said that, unfortunately, a decision made by Mnuchin, according to the New York Times, won't make it any easier for Biden to handle the economy. Well, let's go to the source, the New York Times. Now, this is what the headline stated, Mnuchin's inglorious endgame. And the New York Times couldn't be more blunt than this. Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin is spending his last few months in office trying to undermine President-elect Joe Biden and the American economy. How is Mnuchin going about this? Well, the Trump administration is reportedly abruptly curtailing the Federal Reserve's emergency lending programs. These are safety net programs that Americans rely on during these desperate times. Here is what Paul McCulley, former PIMCO chief, economist, and senior fellow at Cornell University, said about the Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin's decision in his appearance on CNBC.
You said you don't buy the fact that there wasn't a political flavor here. What do you mean by that, Paul? You think this was a deliberate attempt to sabotage President-elect Biden's economic tools?
I don't think it was a deliberate attempt to do so, but certainly they didn't have to do it now. And actually, they limited to a degree the optionality or flexibility that the new Treasury Secretary would have. So that's what I mean by political, because a good, peaceful, smooth transition shouldn't be throwing sand into your successor's job. And I think that's what he did. So that's why I mean it had a flavor of a political action.
The unemployment crisis is yet another challenge on the path of the incoming U.S. president. The overall U.S. unemployment rate is currently 6.9%, which, while better than April's 14.7%, still means that 10 million pre-pandemic jobs are lost.
The real problem of reinvigorating industry in the United States is trying to figure out how to get small and medium-sized enterprises to restart, to go back on the track, because in fact it is the small and medium-sized industries that create most of the jobs, most of the opportunities, and have much of the opportunity for innovation, both in the environment and in a better quality of life.
Analysts say people who have been unemployed for 6 months or more are about twice as likely to drop out of the labor force as to find employment. Additionally, the longer a person is out of work, the less consumer purchasing they do, which further slows economic growth. Data shows that long-term unemployment as a share of all unemployment is growing fast across the U.S. In October, 3.6 million of the 11 million unemployed Americans had been out of work for 6 months or longer. That's a ratio that is not seen since mid-2014, when Biden was the country's vice president and the unemployment rate, like today, surpassed 6%. The continuing unemployment crisis has led economists to become increasingly pessimistic about when the country might return to pre-pandemic levels. Business and academic economists surveyed by the Wall Street Journal in April predicted that the labor market would recover by 2022. But when surveyed again in October, 55% had extended the recovery forecast to the year 2023 or later.
Time now to bring in Atefeh Paridar. She's our researcher and journalist, and she joins us now to tell us more about the state of the U.S. economy. Welcome. So this time around, you're not only going to share with us your media post, but you were also the writer of this program. So obviously you have a lot to say.
Yeah, well, I took to the social media because obviously Americans on social media, as I found out, are as divided as they are outside social media on whether Biden is the right guy for reviving the economy and salvaging the the country from the pandemic. Well, there are a lot of guys who think that since Biden was the vice president of Obama and did the great job back in 2009 after the Great Recession, and Biden helped Obama to revive the economy and create jobs, so he's the man for the job. They think that he can do this. But, you know, this is a total different situation because that was something about mortgage, and that recession was not due to the pandemic. We have to see if Biden can do this. A pro-Trump account is saying that Biden supported trade, the working economy, world peace, and low unemployment rate for a guy who just not Trump. You're all functioning retarded. Sorry for that last word.
No, that's okay.
Yeah, well, they're saying that things are already good. Why we have to bring another guy that we don't know if he has a plan or not? A lot of them are saying that Biden is going to let China take over the world economy. As we know, China at the moment is the second biggest economy in the world, and they are the U.S. biggest rival. So they're saying that Biden is not the man for the job.
Okay, if he gets to confirm that. Thank you so much for that. We appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Of course. Thank you. Atif Epaida there about the state of the U.S. economy and the social media post. All right. We couldn't cover the U.S. economy without talking about the unemployment situation. As usual, there's a disparity between the official figures and the actual number of people who are unemployed. Number which is, well, it's said to be perhaps over 30 million. And that is a result of the pandemic.
The killing of George Floyd, an unarmed African-American man at the hands of a white police officer, was the start of yet another wave of nationwide anti-racism protests in the U.S. Massive rallies and mobilizations against racial discriminations brought America's ongoing struggle with racism to the fore. But the ugly face of systemic racism is not just shown in viral videos. It has also been apparent as COVID-19 affects black communities in particular.
Racial inequality is extraordinarily evident and will involve recreating some of the basis for trying to overcome the profound political, cultural, and social inequalities that characterize the United States at the present time.
Official figures show that African Americans are less likely to have health insurance. This holds true even among the employed. Black workers are 60% more likely to be uninsured than white workers. Along with the lack of coverage, Black Americans have higher rates of chronic illnesses, including diabetes, high blood pressure, and obesity. All these conditions contribute to making the coronavirus pandemic all the more deadly for blacks than for whites, whom accounts for more than 60% of the population, but only about 53% of the deaths from the virus. Higher rates of infection and death among minorities demonstrate the racial character of inequality in America. All being said, observers believe that the next president of the United States won't be able to fix the economy or save the nation from the deadly disease unless he addresses the systemic racism that divides Americans. Addressing the pandemic's health and economic effects requires acknowledging these facts and acting accordingly. Back in September, it's been estimated that the U.S. has lost $16 trillion as a result of discrimination against African Americans. A new study conducted by Citigroup shows that since the year 2000, the U.S. gross domestic product has lost that much as a result of discriminatory practices in a range of areas, including in education and access to business loans. And not acting to reverse discriminatory practices will continue to exact the cost. Citigroup estimates that the economy would see a $5 trillion boost over the next 5 years if the U.S. were to tackle key areas of discrimination against minorities.
While the U.S. President Donald Trump is pushing ahead, trying to invalidate the results of the U.S. presidential election and drawing up plans to, attack Iran, Americans are dying. Shouldn't he focus on the economy more? But what about the fight on the economic front? Are there enough efforts that are being applied against the devastation that the COVID-19 is causing, like unemployment and hunger? I mean, a stock market that is performing well, well, that's not the only barometer that the economy is actually doing well. If Trump is out and the U.S. President-elect Biden is confirmed, what guarantees are there that he will be able to fix the problem? Just throwing money at the problem is not the solution, which is actually one of his solutions. It is reported that he's going to go on a $7 trillion spending spree. Where is that money going to come from? That's all the time we have for this week's episode. On behalf of myself, Kavit Halfway, and the whole team here on Economic Divide, stay safe and see you again next time. علي حبه جنة وسيم النار والجنة وسي المصطفى حقا إمام الناس والجنة. The Gate of Knowledge. Exegesis and interpretations of the supremely eloquent sermons, letters, and sayings of the Commander of the Faithful, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him.
You're listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وعلى أهل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين. Dear listeners to IRIB English Radio, welcome to this episode of The Gate of Knowledge. We are trying to understand from this great man in the history of Islam called Imam Ali alayhi salam about what it means to be pious. We've heard about piety in the scriptures, in different scriptures, even in the Abrahamic scriptures, and the scripture after that to the scriptures of Islam, the Holy Quran. The word taqwa, piety, has been repeated constantly. But what does it mean? And who is a pious person? This issue can only be explained to us by one who has lived a life of piety, one who has experienced piety at its peak, and one who has seen the results in his own life. And of course that is Imam al-Muttaqin, the leader of the pious people, Imam Ali alayhi salam, who has written, or rather he has authored or narrated reportedly the book called Nahjul Balagha. We are discussing the sermon number 184, which is the sermon of the pious people, and the sermon where he explains to us what it means to be pious and what are the qualities of one who is pious. In the previous session, we discussed and said one of the qualities is that a pious person is one whose mistakes are few. And we said that one of the reasons is that a pious person is one who has knowledge and he is not ignorant. Number one. Number two is that he's one who controls his angers and his desires.
You are listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio, a program that presents a detailed commentary of Peak of Eloquence from the Master of the Faithful, Imam Ali, peace be upon him.
Now, if you recall, in the previous session, we had said that the reason why a person would make mistakes either is because, number one, that person is ignorant. As such, a pious person needs to be one of knowledge. You cannot be a person who is pious but not have knowledge. It doesn't make sense. Because a pious person is one who does the duties of God, one who acts in accordance to the will of God. If he doesn't know what God's will is, then originally he is not one who is pious at all. Number two, we said that it's because of weakness maybe. Weakness, we said in Islam, if it is to do with physical weakness, there are substitutes for all the actions. A person cannot claim to be weak and therefore, because of weakness, not perform the duties of Islam. And that is impossible. Because there are substitutes for everything. And I gave examples. There are a person who cannot pray while standing, he can pray while seated. If he cannot pray while sitting, then he can pray while sleeping. Even if he cannot pray while moving even any part of his body, he can just pray by moving his eyes. If he cannot pray by moving his eyes, then he can pray in his thoughts to this degree. You see? So weakness is not an excuse. Sometimes a person may say, okay, sometimes there are no substitutes. Like what? Like in the situation of jihad. You can't say, I'm weak and therefore I will not perform jihad. I will not fight against oppression. By jihad, we mean fighting against oppression. Not fighting for the sake of fighting. Fighting against evil, against darkness. A person can't say that I will just sit around because I'm weak. There is no excuse. Of course, there are certain aspects of the Sharia where excuses are given for those who are blind and those who have certain physical disabilities. But a time may come when everyone may be needed to defend themselves. And in this situation, it becomes necessary. So weakness is not a good example, physical weakness, but maybe you can say spiritual weakness, whereby a person finds his desires and anger to be overwhelming over him. And this is mostly because of the errors that a person makes himself. If a person from the very onset is not careful about his desires, about the anger, about the love of the world, about the spiritual maladies that are there in his heart, then they will one day become a nightmare and overcome him.
Stay tuned to the IRIB English Radio.
Now, one of the reasons why a person may commit mistakes in his life is because of internal, inherent problems that exist in his soul. He may have the knowledge of what is right, but jealousy, the love of this world, laziness. You know, a person used to taking it easy, right? Or for example, desires, love of, let's say, enjoying things that are unlawful. This love of the world, this love for power and fame, this may make him make mistakes and errors. This is mostly because of the awareness about God is weak, because the love of God is weak in that person's heart. No wonder it is that the pious person is one whose heart is filled with the love of God. The love of God is so powerful that it burns away all the other darknesses. It burns away all the other spiritual problems and difficulties. It burns away the anger, the desires. It burns away the jealousy. And it causes that heart to be, prepared to always do what is right. So when a person sees that the desires and the anger and the other spiritual problems are affecting him, then he should know the problem probably lies in the fact that he has not strengthened the love of God in his heart. And the love of God in the heart will only come when a person contemplates on the wonderful things that God has given him. Number one. Number two, a person takes some practical steps to thank God, to to appreciate those wonderful things that God has given him. And this love will start to overwhelm his heart. And that's why then, slowly and gradually, the mistakes will reduce. And the final reason that a person who is pious, a person might make mistakes in life is the issue of ghafla. Inshallah, in the next session, we will discuss about the issue of ghafla. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome, on the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio.
قال النبي محمد من كنت مولاه هذا علي سيد فاز من ولاه هو بالكتاب مسدد والنور معناه باب العلوم ومرشد هو آيات الله من ناداه أو لبه حين دعاه نال مناه هو في الشدائد منجد والفضل يمناه هو في المحاسن أحمد والوحي رباه.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
First methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
Ya ayyuha alladhina amanu, O you who believe, ista'inu bis-sabri was-salah.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Today we listen to the speech of Hujjatul Islam Salim Yusuf Ali.
Throughout the course of the previous evenings, we had the opportunity to look at the concept of injustice and justice with inspiration from Imam Hussein alayhi salam's mission and his struggle. And we've looked at it from many different angles, whether it be the interaction with people of injustice, whether it be trying to identify what is the greatest act of injustice, and other perspectives as well. When we talk about interaction with others, there's one time when we discuss what effect that interaction is going to have on us. And that's something that we had a chance to address in the previous night. But there's another perspective when you look and see how is it that you are supposed to interact with others? How can you influence others? And that's what I'd like to focus on this evening. And as a focal point for our discussion, I want to first quote a verse which appears at the end of Surah An-Nahl. It's a verse that I'm sure all of the lovers of the Quran are familiar with. Allah Ta'ala says, أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. إن الله يأمر بالعدل والإحسان وإيتاء ذي القربى وينهى عن الفحشاء والمنكر والبغي يعظكم لعلكم تذكرون. Allah Ta'ala commands you to towards justice, and He commands you to have ihsan, and He commands you to take care of the near ones and the orphans, and to He prevents you from injustice, and He prevents you from sinfulness. perhaps you may be amongst those who remember. And this verse contains some very, it's a wide-ranging verse, which gives us a very practical prescription, both on an individual level and on a societal level, of how Allah wants us to operate. But you could say that to sum up, Allah in this verse tells us and commands us towards justice in everything that we do, and He prevents us and prohibits us from committing acts of injustice. And this verse was often quoted by the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam. For example, we're told according to reports, that when our Prophet used to recite his sermons, he would end by reciting this verse. It's kind of like a summation of everything else that he would like to convey to the people. What I'd like to do tonight is to focus on the first two parts of that, where Allah says, "Inna Allah ya'amuru bil adli wal ihsan." Allah commands you towards justice and towards ihsan. A lot of times, ihsan is translated as doing good. So Allah commands you towards being just and doing good. But according to some of the commentaries of the Quran by some of the greatest commentators, they explain that ihsan is actually something which guides us how to interact with others on a superior level, in a way which is more fruitful than just on the level of justice. So let me explain what ihsan actually means, and then we'll talk about its relationship to justice, and then we'll talk about some of the applications of that in our lives. Allah Ta'ala, in many verses in the Quran, He mentions this concept of ihsan. And ihsan refers to doing something in the best way possible. In one of the ahadith reported from our Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa alihi, he says that try to do ihsan in everything that you do. Every single action that you perform, try to do it not just in a way where you're doing wajib and staying away from haram, or doing halal and staying away from haram, but do it with ihsan. And then he gives an example. He says that when you go and you take an animal to the slaughtering house and you're about to slaughter it, then before you do so, then make sure that you give the animal some water. Make sure that the instrument that you're going to be using to do the cutting, that you've sharpened that blade, so that when the cut is made, it is done in a swift way. Make sure that when you actually do that cut, that you do so in a way which is fast, right? Not something that is sort of delayed. Make sure that once you do it, that you don't move the corpse of the body. Let the life exit it, and then you go ahead and you move it. Make sure that when you do it, then there is no other animal which can see this happening, nor can it see the other animals, and so on and so forth. All of those are present in the traditions of the Ahlul Bayt. They teach us that when you want to slaughter an animal, you think about all these other things as well too. You know, imagine, just as a side point, in today's economy of like mass production, when they want to do this type of thing, they build factories and they build like these conveyor belts, and they hang up the animals, and they want to do it very fast, right? Do you think they have time to do this type of special things, like this type of ihsan? But this is what our Prophet calls us to do. Now, is it wajib to do these things? No. But it is something which leads to a higher level of operation. Like when you want to achieve this goal of having this animal, and being able to have dinner and whatnot, then there's one way you do it, and you take it just a very, okay, what do I got to do? What's the basic sort of thing? And that time you look and see, how can you make it be done in an excellent way? That same concept of doing things in an excellent way applies to everything else that we do as well. There's one famous hadith which is reported in both the books of hadith of the Ahlus Sunnah as well as the Shia as well, where Jibreel alayhi salam appears in the form of a human being, and he came to the Prophet and he asks him some questions. And of course, this was in order for the people to learn. So one of the things he asks him is, what is the meaning of ihsan? Okay, and Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa sallam says to him, say salawat please. So he says to him that ihsan is for you to worship Allah as if you can see him. And if you cannot see him, then you should know that he sees you. Now, I'm sure that you've heard this tradition narrated before. I wonder if we've gotten a chance to ponder upon it. It's something which is an extremely rich and very one of those ahadith which you can really, really take a lot from. In this hadith, there are at least two levels of awareness that are referred to, where somebody can reach and worship Allah at those levels. One of them is the level where it's as if they can see Allah Ta'ala. And another level is where they cannot, it's not as if they can see Allah, but they are aware that He is seeing them. And in that, there's something we can practically take, just as a side point, that when we get a chance, or when we can, when we have the opportunity to do so, when we're not so busy with other things, especially when we are worshiping Allah, let us just have this come to our minds, that we are in the presence of Allah. The entire world is in the presence of Allah. And that itself is a type of awareness which can really change the quality of everything that we do, especially the acts of worship that we perform. Now, going back to this topic of ihsan, here the Prophet is talking about worshiping, but it's a higher level of worship. It's a worship which has more quality to it. So one time you can talk about slaughtering an animal, and you can do so in a way where you're observing these extra etiquette, and that becomes like the most beautiful and excellent way of doing so. And there's another time where you're talking about the acts of worship and, you know, all those things that we do to strive to get closer to Allah. And the Prophet is saying that even worshiping as well, there's ihsan in that as well too. One time you talk about a level of just like, what's the bare minimum you need to do in order to get it correct. Another time you say, well, what if you want to actually have this be a source of elevation and proximity and spiritual cleansing? So that's when you talk about those type of things. Now, that same concept of ihsan is something that has been applied to the relationships that we have to other people, with other people. There's one time when you describe relationships on the level of huquq and rights and responsibilities, and you say that, okay, well, I'm in this relationship, this is the way that these are the rights that I have on you, and these are the rights you have on me. And we have to make sure that, you know, we're always fulfilling these rights. And if you are going to be somebody who goes against my rights, then I'm going to take you to account for that. Why? Because that's what justice calls for. Justice calls for rights to be observed, putting everything in its proper place, observing the rights. In a society, when you're trying to like run things in a way where there's order, there's system, right? You, when you have a government, when you have, like, let's say, you know, people's like property rights and, you know, companies and all that, you do need to have this type of approach where everything is like legal, you have rights and responsibility and whatnot.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
روحي كريم عظيم عليم حليم حكيم متين غفور شكور ودود قيوم رؤوف صبور مجيد اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد يا مؤمنين صلوا عليه.
everyone, this is John. You are with me for another episode of our weekly show, The Subcontinent. Our program focuses on few of the most critical, sensitive, and important issues in the subcontinent, which is a region which hosts almost 25% of the global population. So let's dive into our segment, break down issues, take expert opinion, and see what people say.
In this edition of the subcontinent, we shall look into India's railway privatization. Also, we will explore the pros and cons of this bumpy road.
India's government is moving ahead with its privatization initiative in many spheres. Now, it is time for the Indian Railways. The Indian Railways is the third largest railway network in the world by size, with a route length of about 70,000 kilometers. It has always been the network that connects India, but opening it to private investors may make it less available for most of the people.
The privatization of Indian railways has been recommended for many decades. But recently, the government officially started the process to allow private firms to operate passenger trains on its network via 151 new trains. This marks the beginning of private sector participation in passenger train operations. Last year, the government decided that the Indian Railways will restructure all its 7 production units and associated workshops, including like ICF Perambur, RCF Kapurthula, Modern Coach Factory and Raibareli, into a cooperation called Indian Railways Roll Stocking Company. The railways is not the only sector Prime Minister Narendra Modi's government is opening to the corporates. The government has already invited the private firms to other sectors like coal mines, banks, defense, oil, insurance, electricity, telecom, space and atomic energy.
They are selling off the public sector, big factories and institutions. Even the railways are being privatized. One train has been sold. And the people working on that train have to work for 18 hours of the day. They have fallen sick. This is the future that they are showing.
The process has its own merits and demerits, as experts say the measure is a clash between the consequences of the need for modernization versus social obligations.
A few weeks ago, in early July 2020, the Railway Ministry announced that 151 trains in 109 pair of routes will be operated by private sectors with a 30,000 crore rupees investment. There are ideas and people both in favor and against the plan. Some see privatization as the way forward and some mention the unfavorable outcomes that may follow the move.
Although the initial phase of the privatization would cover a small part of the entire railway network, liberalizing the entry of new operators in the public transport may be the path for improving services and facilitating growth of the sector. Those in favor of the project believe fares in private trains will be competitive and the introduction of private players would eventually increase the number of trains, ensuring high availability on demand and punctuality. The proponents argue that privatization means higher quality of services, which can help India renovate its fleet and accommodate the latest technology in railways, coaches, safety and traveling experience. They say privatization will lead to better infrastructure, which in turn would lead to improved safety, reduction in travel time and etc. Indian railway services are marred by issues like lack of punctuality, mismanagement in the form of stinking washrooms, lack of water supply and dirty platforms. Privatization may solve these issues as the move would foster competition and hence lead to overall betterment in the quality of services. Thereby, it may help Indian railways to become a world-class network, but some believe it may simply backfire.
The proponents of privatization say that it creates jobs and fosters modernization. But those on the other side argue that only the driver and guard will be railway employees. all other employees will be part of the private company who has won the contract to operate the train. The private companies are free to procure train and locomotives from any source of their choice. This may be a threat to national production and self-reliance.
Opponents of India's privatization of railways speak of numerous limitations for the project, including increased fares and disconnecting some less trodden parts of the country. Not unexpectedly, private enterprise runs on profit, and the easiest way to profit from their investment may be to hike fares. The huge increase in the ticket fare would render the service beyond the reach of lower-income groups and destroy the initial purpose of the railways, which is meant to serve the entire population irrespective of the level of income. An advantage of government-owned railways is that it provides nationwide connectivity to bring regional development. This would not continue with privatization because routes which are less popular, hence less profitable, may be neglected. This can have a negative impact on connectivity. Some parts of the country, including regions with rugged terrain and low population density, like Himalayan states and northeastern states, may become virtually inaccessible. Privatization may drop them out of the process of development.
Another concern about the plan is the confusion on land titles and land use as the properties are dated. The railways company says that there is no change required in the regulations to carry out the project, but local authorities in many places do not agree to it. Most of the stations are located in the crowded and old parts of the cities, away from the new infrastructure. To make the project commercially viable, a holistic plan for the development of the entire catchment area is required, instead of just the standalone station plan. According to the data maintained by the World Bank, in 2018, India had 68,443 kilometers of route of railways. It is among the four largest rail networks in the world, along with the United States, China, and Russia. Although every kilometer of track in India covers geographical area much less than Germany, Russia, China, or Canada, indicating scope for expansion.
If the privatization of Asia's oldest railway is implemented as planned, modern trains will be added to the network, which needs heavy investment in rolling stock like coaches and engines. Moreover, there is the cost of operations, which includes electricity, manpower, and all other equipment. Such a scenario means all the facilities should be upgraded with better onboard services and faster trains. Who's going to pay this huge modernization expense? The railways company, private investors, or people? The plan enables investors to make money either by monetizing land and airspace by setting up shops, kiosks, advertisement hoardings, parking lots, offices, and residential properties. The sector is already in decline and losing business to other modes like air and road. Operating passenger trains is a loss-making business for Indian Railways. It recovers only around 57% of the cost through tickets on an average. The rest is cross-subsidized through earnings from its freight operations.
All right, gentlemen, our team has collected a few media coverages in this regard, which we would really appreciate if you could take a look. So let's just get to the media and then we can come back to the question answer session. Please stay with us.
Asia's oldest rail network will invite applications for modernizing stations across the country every month. But for that, Indian Railways will have to overcome delays, streamline approvals, and cut red tape, things that derailed the effort earlier. But drawing interest from the private sector for station upgrade has been harder than thought, as delays and stringent conditions made it unviable. Envisioned in 2004 to 2005, the project failed to take off. Modi renewed it in 2016